Do you feel like you're going through life clouded by doubt? Talk to California Psychics. Our trusted and accurate psychics are available 24/7, and we guarantee if it's not life-changing, it's free. Download the app or connect with us at californiapsychics.com. Right now, new customers get 80% off their first reading. Experience the joy of certainty. California Psychics.
Why do so many dogs die before their time? Actress and dog activist Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. Superfood Complete by Badlands Ranch is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including premium protein-packed beef, nutrient-dense organ meat, heart-healthy salmon, gut-healthy vegetables, and several superfoods vital to your dog's health. And because high-heat cooking can add unhealthy things to your dog's food, Superfood Complete uses air drying, so it gets cooked low and slow. This means it has the convenience of kibble, but the health benefits of whole foods. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible benefits, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 right now to get up to 50% off your order and a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's badlandsranch.com/save50 today. All dogs are unique. Your dog's results can and will vary.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. We've got another episode for you this week. We are back with Dad again. We've got, believe it or not, and I bet any of you would have guessed this, we're doing another naval one, because that seems to be Dad's speciality. It is what he mentioned it to me earlier. It's one I've heard of. I have heard of the battle. I don't know anything about it. It's one, you know, like when you hear something in history and you think, oh yeah, I've heard of that, but I couldn't tell you anything other than it was naval. Like, I wouldn't know a single thing about it, so I'm going to just sit back and enjoy this one because this is a new one for me. I don't know a thing. So
you can make as many comments as you like as we go through it.
Don't I always?
Of course. But there we go. Right. For this particular podcast, I knew quite a bit about the actual incident anyway, and I just thought I'd do a bit more research just to add some details to the bits that I already knew. So what am I going to talk about? I'm going to talk about an incident that occurred on the 13th of December, 1939.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it's called the Battle of the River Plate.
Yes.
All right. So, we're talking British history.
Yeah.
And for us, the Second World War began on the 1st of September, 1939.
Yes, it did. 2 years before the Americans. Okay. And however, about 6 years after the Chinese. Because the Chinese was fighting the Japanese in 1933. So, you know.
But yeah. So the official start of the Second World War is the 1st of September, 1939. Yes. And today we're going to go back to the first naval battle of that war.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the first naval engagement. That privilege goes to the sinking of the Royal Oak, HMS Royal Oak, in the Royal Navy's home base at Scapa Flow by U-47 on the 14th of October, 1939. With a loss of 800 sailors.
But haven't you dived that ship as well?
Not the Royal Oak, but I have dived in Scapa Flow.
Yeah.
Yes, we did a couple of holidays up there because, believe it or not, there's a lot of German ships in Scapa Flow.
Yes.
And I might actually do a podcast on that.
Yeah, you should.
Yeah, the reason the German ships are in the British Royal Navy's home port for the Second World War, and it's not just a port, it's 120 square miles of natural harbour.
Yeah.
It's a vast place. But it's Scapa Flow, it's in northern Scotland. But the Royal Oak wasn't exactly a battle. It was one-sided. Only one side fired any shots. And so this is the first recognised major battle.
Yes.
Of
the Second World War.
The naval battle of the Second World War. Okay?
Yeah.
So, in the 1930s, Germany knew that war was coming. If it was going to come, and it was kind of likely, it would most likely pitch themselves against Britain. Now, they were fully aware that Germany as a country could produce enough food to feed itself. Mm. Britain, on the other hand, could not. As an island, Britain would need to supply food or import food from other sources. Mm-hmm. And the only way to get sufficient provisions was by sea. Now, Britain at the time had the biggest and most feared navy in the world, so a direct attack was not an option. That's certainly not a good idea. But an attack on unprotected merchant ships, that's feasible.
Yes.
Now, the Royal Navy knew, as did Germany, that the Royal Navy couldn't be everywhere. And if the ships bringing food and royal supplies could be stopped, or better still, sunk, Germany would starve Britain into submission and Germany would win.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Germany had three ways of doing this. They had the magnetic mine. They had the U-boat, the Unterseeboot.
Yeah.
And something called a surface raider. They had three ways of attacking. So, well before the war actually started, Germany started building up its military equipment. And that was in contravention of the Treaty of Versailles, which basically limited Germany on what it could build and what it could use.
And took half their land off them.
Yeah.
Wonder why they were annoyed. That could be an episode, the Treaty of Versailles.
That certainly could. But before the war started, Germany had started building military equipment.
Mm.
They'd been building tanks, planes and ships, and they'd produced them in numbers. Hitler and his military leaders had learnt from the First World War that if Germany was to succeed in creating the Third Reich, she needed to have superiority in the air, on the land and, of course, on the sea. And as a result, Germany's industry had been active for many years.
Hmm.
Amongst the military hardware produced between the two wars were three ships. The Deutschland, the Admiral Scheer, and the Admiral Graf Spee. Or Graf Spee. But
yeah.
It's spelt Spee, S-P-E-E. But it's pronounced the Graf Spee. They're not exceptionally big. But when these three ships actually conformed, when they were built, they conformed to the limitations opposed by the Versailles Treaty. And that meant that nominally they had to be under a 10,000 ton limit.
Yes.
That's not big for a ship.
No, it's not.
However, once they were fitted out, they all considerably exceeded it, and they were well over 16,000 tons. Each of these three ships was 610 feet long by 71 feet across, and Germany classified them as a Panzerschiffe.
Yeah.
An armoured ship.
Yeah.
The British gave them a classification of pocket battleship, which, to be honest, in my opinion, is a far more accurate description.
Mm.
They were fast, they were well armoured, they were compact, they had substantial firepower, up to three times the firepower of a comparable ship.
Yeah.
They were faster than any ship more heavily armed, and more heavily armed than any ship that was faster.
Yeah, so they were basically the Ferrari of their day. They were the best.
To save on weight, they were the first ships of their size to actually be welded rather than were riveted, which resulted in a smoother surface, less water resistance, made them faster. Their engines were quite different to normal
battleships
of the day. There were 8 9-cylinder diesel engines, not the conventional steam turbines. And these diesel engines gave the ship a power output of over 55,000 horsepower and a top speed of over 28 knots, which, for those of you who aren't that good at it, it's 33 miles an hour.
Mm.
They also had a massive range of almost 19,000 miles.
That's quite a lot.
They were high-speed gun platforms and the perfect vessels to start what would become the longest battle in history. The Battle of the Atlantic. September 3rd, 1939 to the 8th of May, 1945. 5 years, 8 months, 5 days. The Battle of the Atlantic.
You're not getting that in our podcast, are you?
No, I'm not going to make that in an hour podcast. No. Be a nice one, though, but yeah, it's a massive one, isn't it? The Battle of the Atlantic. They weren't perfect, though. To reduce weight, the Germans had reduced the amount of armour plating, and although their big guns, and there were 6 28-centimetre guns in 2 turrets, that's 11-inch guns for those that aren't sort of technically minded, and these guns had a range of 22 kilometres, there was a flaw with them.
Yeah.
They could only target one enemy at a time.
Right, okay.
So it left one side of the ship vulnerable and open to attack. They were basically designed to be hit-and-run specialists. Pull up, see a ship, guns turn to it, bang, off.
Yeah.
Yeah?
You're not going to sink them like that, though. I don't know, the Bismarck did the hood in one shot, didn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, both turrets could only fire
in one direction.
Yeah, so if they were going to attack a ship on the left-hand side, both turrets would go to the left. Hmm. You couldn't get one turret to the left, one turret to the right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was built for attack, not defence. And this story features one of these ships, the Admiral Graf Spee. It was launched on the 30th of June 1934 and entered service about 18 months later, 6th of January 1936. And she deserves the description of pocket battleship. She was an excellent example of a surface raider and could be described realistically as a tiger of the seas. She was fast, she was well armoured, she was extremely manoeuvrable, considerable firepower, and the convoys and their protective ships would have been no match for her or her sisters. They were the perfect 20th century high sea pirate ships.
Hmm.
Now, Germany had a plan to utilise her and her sister ships to attack and harass merchant ships bringing supplies to Britain. And up until 1939, Germany had built U-boats. But it only built 56 U-boats.
Quite a lot, though, considering they weren't allowed to build any. It's like...
Surface raiders were thought to be a better option because they could remain at sea for a lot longer. They were faster. They had a more substantial impact. Mind you, as it turned out, at the end of the war, this would be proved wrong. Germany only ever built 3 of these Panzerschiffs.
Wow.
But they eventually built 1,167 U-boats.
Yeah, quite a few.
Quite a few. But even this number would turn out to be insufficient. I mean, on the U-boat front, 768 were lost, 238 were sunk by their own side, 156 were surrendered. There are 5 that are unaccounted for.
One of them took Hitler to Argentina.
Of course it did. Yeah. Yeah, of course it did. But they've so very nearly succeeded. Not by the tonnage that they actually sank, but by the fear that they instilled in the merchant sailors who manned the supply ships. You're going across the Atlantic. It's a few day voyage. You got a U-boat. You can't see it. You can't hear it. First you know it's there. Bang, torpedo. You're going down.
Yeah.
It's cold. It's wet. No ship is going to stop to pick you up because they're going to get... It just...
Yeah.
The psychological side of the German U-boats, amazing.
Did we... I know you was about to say something. Did we have... I know we had submarines.
We did.
We didn't have that many, though, did we?
We had a fair number.
But not over 1,000.
No, nowhere near. The Germans were the U-boat specialists. Mm. The American submarines were extremely useful. Mm. But they didn't use them in the way that the Germans did. The Germans had a way of dealing with it.
Yeah.
And there was... It was... You know, they very nearly won it with the U-boats. But the reason they didn't win it was technological advances for locating them were improved during the war.
Yeah.
You know, Aztec, which is a forerunner of sonar, and that's it. So eventually, U-boats couldn't hide.
Yeah.
And this resulted in the German U-boat service eventually having the highest casualty rate of any force in any country during the Second World War.
Wow.
Their casualty rate for German U-boat sailors was 80%.
Yeah, that's not good.
Like 4 out of every 5 didn't come home.
Yeah, that's really not good.
Yeah. Wow. So, anyway, that's the U-boats. I love U-boats. I think I love submarines. They're one of my favourite forms of transport.
I've been in a submarine.
For interesting side of things.
I've been in a submarine.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I've seen a few.
In Barbados.
Oh, right.
It was your uncle that was piloting it.
Yes, it's funny that.
Yeah. It was good.
It was the Atlantis too, wasn't it?
Yeah, the Atlantis, yeah. So there you go. For any of you who have been on that was... piloted by my great uncle.
Yes.
So
yes. No longer with us, unfortunately. No, he's not, no. But there we are. Okay, so we go back to our service radar.
Yes.
Okay. 10 days before the start of World War II, so we're talking the 21st of August. One of these pocket battleships sailed from a German port with secret orders. She sailed by night up the coast of Norway through the Denmark Strait, which is actually between Iceland and Greenland.
Yeah, nowhere near
Denmark. Disappeared. Into the Atlantic. She met up with a supply ship 3 days later, August the 24th, and turned south and entered the South Atlantic, where she remained unknown to the world. On the day war was declared, her whereabouts weren't known. She wasn't even a consideration. That ship was the Admiral Graf Spee. Hitler knew that war was coming, and he'd sent the Graf Spee prior to the declaration with orders to attack British merchant ships in the southern oceans. It was a second part to Hitler's plan. If the Graf Spee could lure some of the British Royal Navy ships away from protecting the coastline, then this would reduce Britain's ability to defend itself against a potential German invasion. So her orders were... to sink as many British merchant ships as possible.
Mm.
But she had to wait.
Yeah.
Britain and Germany weren't at war.
No.
Until the 1st of September. And the Graf Spee was now in the perfect position to carry out her orders. Hitler makes a broadcast that Polish troops have attacked Germany and German forces have retaliated and invaded Poland. Despite Hitler not believing that Britain would go to war over Poland, we did.
Yeah, we did.
The Second World War began. Captain Langsdorff and the Graf Spee are stationed somewhere off the coast of Africa, waiting for additional instructions. 3 weeks after the start of the Second World War, on September the 26th, the German High Command gave Captain Langsdorff authorization to start commerce war against British interests. So off she went to the west and Britain's trade routes with South America.
Mm-hmm.
On the 30th of September, the Admiral Graf Spee's a radar aircraft spotted a cargo ship, the Clement, off the coast of Brazil. Langsdorff had his ship place the first two shots across the bow of the Clement, causing her crew to fear for their safety and come to a stop. She did, however, manage to transmit an RRR signal, which was code for "I am under attack by a raider." Why they would have that code right at the start of the war, when they didn't even know that the Graf Spee was out there, I have no idea, but it was a code, RRR, that's what it meant. The Graf Spee took the Clement's captain and chief engineer prisoner, but left the rest of the crew in the lifeboats and to abandon their ship, so they put them in the lifeboats. The raider then fired around 30 rounds of one of her smaller guns and put two torpedoes into the cargo ship, which broke up and sank. Langsdorff ordered a distress signal to be sent to the naval base at Pernambuco in Brazil. And that was to make sure that a rescue party was going to come to the Clement's crew.
Yeah.
Because they were in a lifeboat in the South Atlantic.
Yeah, and that is kind of naval law.
Yeah. The message was picked up by the British Admiralty, who knew exactly what was going on, and sent out a warning to merchant ships that a German surface raider was in the South Atlantic and in the area. I mean, to be honest, the crew of the Clement weren't actually rescued. They made it to Brazil on their own without any help in the lifeboats.
Really?
Yeah. So they reached the Brazilian coast without any help. But,
wow.
Yeah, that's beside the... Langsdorff ensured that the rules governing engagement were followed. Well, basically, the attacking ship needed to ensure the safety of the merchant crew before sinking their ship, unless that ship refused to come to a halt when requested.
Mm-hmm.
And Langsdorff was first and foremost a sailor, a navy man, and a German. But he wasn't a Nazi.
No. Well, a lot of Germans weren't at the start.
He just made sure that his ship fought by the rules. So we go back to one of my other podcasts where the submarine commander did the same thing.
Yes.
Yeah. You have to look at that one.
Oh, I can't remember what it was called. What was it called?
The Laconia.
The Laconia. Yeah, that's the one.
The Laconia incident, or the Laconia incident. Now, realising there was a German surface raider at large in the South Atlantic, the Royal Navy joined forces with the French Navy.
Oh, God.
You love the French, don't you?
I don't like... I can't stand the French.
Oh, dear. Between them, they sent a number of ships to hunt down the Graf Spee.
Was this before or after they gave up?
This is before.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So the British aircraft carriers, the Hermes, the Eagle and the Ark Royal, and the French aircraft carrier, the Bern, the British battlecruiser, the Renown, and the French battleships, the Dunkirk and Strasbourg, in addition to 16 cruisers, were all sent to find this German raider.
This one little ship.
That's a lot of... That's
some serious firepower for one tiny ship. Okay.
On the day that this coalition was formed, which, to be honest, was the 5th of October, the Graf Spee encountered another ship, the Newton Beach, which she didn't actually sink. She just took the crew prisoner, commandeered the ship to use as a floating prison for later.
Okay.
So you now got the Graf Spee and the Newton Beach. The next ship to encounter the Graf Spee was the Ashley, and she was sunk on the 7th of October. And the following day, the Graf Spee transferred everybody out of the Newton Beach.
Yeah.
And put them on the Graf Spee.
Yeah.
Because the Newton Beach, being a cargo ship and a merchant vessel, it just couldn't keep up.
Yeah, because the Graf Spee was fast.
It was a lot faster. So the captured British seamen now became housed below decks on a pocket battleship itself. On the 10th of October, the Graf Spee encountered a ship called the Huntsman. And not being able to put the crew in the Graf Spee, because she was now full, she stuck a prize crew on board and sent the ship off to a location.
Okay.
So she's now got the Huntsman with a load of crew on board from prisoners.
Yeah.
Put a small German crew on it and told to go to a particular point in the South Atlantic.
Mm.
5 days later, the Graf Spee rendezvoused with a German supply ship. And the ship was called the Altmark. And there she would refuel, rearm, and transfer the prisoners that she had on board.
Yeah.
Onto the Altmark. The Huntsman then arrives, and the prisoners from the Huntsman are transferred to the Altmark.
Okay, that makes sense.
The Graf Spee then sinks the Huntsman.
Yeah.
22nd of October, the Graf Spee encounters and sank the steamer, Trevanion. And by the end of October, she had actually sunk 27,494 tons of shipping. And she did this by making full use of her aircraft, which was an Arado 196 float plane. She sent it out twice a day to look for merchant ships. And when they were found, the aircraft would radio back.
Yeah.
The Graf Spee would go, sink the ship, take the crew on board, and continue on. In an attempt to confuse the British ships actually looking for them, and like you said, there were a lot of them, he sailed east. So Langsdorff took the Graf Spee towards the Indian Ocean.
Okay.
And he continued his attacks on British merchant ships. One of them, the 15th of November, he sank a tanker, the MV Africa Shell. And the following day, stopped an unidentified Dutch steamer, but didn't sink her.
The Dutch weren't in the war.
The Dutch weren't in the war. The Graf Spee now left the Indian Ocean and returned back to the South Atlantic, obviously stopping to refuel from the Altmark. But while she was being refueled, the crew built a dummy gun turret and a second funnel behind the aircraft catapult, which altered the appearance and silhouette of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And it significantly altered it. So any of the British ships looking for it wouldn't be able to identify.
Yeah, makes sense.
And it had the direct... It had the desired effect. The British couldn't work out if the reports of the merchantmen being sunk were being sunk by one ship, two ships, or several ships.
Yeah.
So the joint British and French task force had to be split up to cover as much of the two oceans, the South Atlantic and the Indian Ocean, as much as possible. The pocket battleship had to be found.
Yeah, it's causing a few problems.
It's causing a massive problem. By the end of November, she'd actually sunk 49,095 tons of shipping.
Wow.
And
when you say shipping, do you mean the metalwork of the ship or the cargo?
No, the metalwork of the ship.
Right, okay.
And she'd done it without the loss of a single sailor on either side.
That's pretty impressive, really.
That's not a bad thing. I mean, Langsdorff wasn't in the dark. He knew that the Royal Navy had sent a hell of a lot of ships down to hunt him down. But to be honest, it was part of the plan.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Admiralty had depleted their available number of ships protecting the English Channel by actually sending them on this hunt. And with 1940 fast approaching, German land forces sweeping through Europe, Britain was becoming isolated.
Yeah.
Still, we knew the French were going to stop them.
Yeah, yeah, the French is going to... Yeah, we'll be all right.
We'll be all right. The French will stop them. They won't get past France.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay. On the 6th of December, though, Langsdorff makes a mistake. In fact, he makes two. Now, due to the fact that his crew hadn't performed very well on a night attack, he arranged a searchlight practice.
Mm.
Now, you've got to question his thinking in this. He's in command of a ship that's being hunted. And he lights up the ship at night?
Yeah, that's not clever, because you can see further at night, especially at light.
His ship can be seen for miles.
Yeah, not clever.
Yeah. That's not the greatest idea from a ship that's supposed to remain invisible. But the lookouts on the Grasse Bay actually spotted a ship on the horizon, but it was just too far away to be identified, so because he was unable to identify it, he just let this vessel carry on.
Yeah.
Well, the ship turned out to be a Norwegian merchant ship, which, unfortunately, signals London with the informant that the information that the pocket battleship is now heading towards South America.
Lucky.
Now, Britain and the Navy in particular needed they were desperate for some good news. It's not been going well for the British.
No.
Churchill had sent the aircraft carrier HMS Courageous out to hunt U-boats.
Yeah.
Well, a U-boat sank it.
Yes, it didn't go very well.
The armed merchant cruiser, the Royal Pindy, was sent to intercept German merchant ships, but the Germans sank it. The Royal Oak, which was the Royal Navy's flagship, which was anchored in the fleet sanctuary inside Scapa Flow, was sunk by a U-boat.
Yeah. Whilst in port, which is...
Whilst in port, yeah. in the most secure harbour the British had.
Yeah. Yeah, it's quite a bad story, that, actually.
The Royal Navy had got no comeback, no counterbalancing victories whatsoever. A rousing sea battle in which the Royal Navy prevailed over fantastic odds was absolutely the ticket to regain public support. And actually, it would solidify Churchill's place as head of the Admiralty, which he was at the time.
Yeah, it's important to remember that, because it was Neville Chamberlain.
It was Neville Chamberlain, yeah.
Churchill didn't declare war.
No. But it wasn't going to be easy, and it certainly wasn't a certain victory.
No.
So now they know where the Grasse Bay is heading.
Mm-hmm.
It's heading towards South America.
That's a lot of ocean to cover, though, isn't it? Do you know what I mean?
Well, you can hide a ship the size of the Grasse Bay. It's just a vast open space, isn't it? It's like, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of square miles, you know, like...
Where there's no one.
Where there is nobody, yeah. So the Admiralty diverted three ships to intercept this German raider en route to South America. And the small group was called Flotilla Group G.
Okay.
Okay, now they were the heavy cruiser HMS Exeter and two light cruisers, Her Majesty's New Zealand ship, the Achilles, and HMS Ajax. And they were dispatched to the South Atlantic. Commanding these ships was a gentleman called Commodore Henry Harwood. Now, Harwood, he has these three ships to command, but he knows that the firepower of the one German ship far exceeds all three put together.
Wow. So it's a smaller ship.
The biggest guns on the Grasse Bay were 11 inches. They were 11-inch bore. The biggest on his ships were 8 inches.
Right.
The German ship had a far greater range on its guns than Group G. In any scenario, the British ships were outgunned and outranged. Their only hope of success was luck and their commander. And for Langsdorff, Harwood was the worst possible opponent. Henry Harwood just happened to be the Admiralty's expert on pocket battleships, and before the war he'd studied them and given lectures on how to combat this type of ship. So okay. He knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
Instead of splitting his force and searching for the Grafspee, Harwood kept them together, gambling that the raider would head for the shipping lanes on the east coast of South America.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is where British spies in South America, along with the Admiralty, began to put out false information. So, fake news.
Yeah. We see
it's called propaganda then, but
yeah,
it was the fake news, and it still goes on. It was going on then, it's going on now.
Oh, yeah, it is.
They let it be known that a convoy to Britain would be leaving South America in the next few days.
Hmm.
German intelligence picked up on the story and relayed it to Langsdorff. The Grafspee and the British Force G were now converging on the mouth of a river off the coast of Uruguay. That river is called the River Plate.
Yeah.
At first light on the 13th of December 1939, the Grafspee's lookout sounded the alert. Two masts were sighted on the dimly lit horizon. Soon after, appeared another one. Yeah. The first mast was identified as the larger ship, the heavy cruiser HMS Exeter, and she's got 8-inch guns. The two vessels with the Exeter were thought to be protecting destroyers. And Captain Langsdorff believed that the Exeter and the destroyers were protecting this imaginary convoy. It was soon discovered, however, that the two destroyers were actually two light cruisers, HMS Ajax and the New Zealander HMS Achilles, each with only 6-inch guns.
Mm.
On the Ajax, Commodore Harwood sent a message to the Admiralty that the raider at large in the South Atlantic had been located and he was going to engage it. He requested any assistance from any Allied ship in the vicinity. Because he knows he's basically screwed.
He's outgunned, yeah.
He's outgunned, he's outpaced, he's outmanoeuvred. All the ships turned and began to steam towards each other. Now, this tactic kind of favoured the British, because the quicker they could close the gap, the greater range of the German ship would become a factor.
Yeah.
Now, the British Commodore Harwood had decided at this point to split his force. Ajax and Achilles went to one side of the Grafspee. HMS Exeter went to the other.
Well, yeah, but they can only fire one side.
The Grafspee can only fire at one side.
Yeah. So
he knows this because he's studied these ships.
Yeah,
and
he knows exactly what's coming.
Harwood was on the Ajax, and he would direct the attack from there. The two larger ships raced towards each other. Now, the two larger ships are the Exeter and the Grafspee. The advantage was held by the Grafspee. It had bigger guns. It had range, but that range was disappearing. And she was rapidly coming within range of Exeter's guns. Just before 6:15 in the morning, the Admiral Grafspee fired the first shots of the day. This straddled the Ajax. And then they targeted the Exeter. From then on, it was just a mass of guns firing at each other. Now, Langsdorff decided the greater threat came from the Exeter, which was the larger of the British ships, so that's where he focused his guns. Within minutes, the Exeter's radio was destroyed. 35 minutes into the battle, both Exeter's front turrets were demolished. Her fire control system was disabled, and she had serious flooding forward. The heavy cruiser maintained decisive gun range as ordered. So she tried to get in really close. But very quickly, she only had one 8-inch gun firing. And that was the rear turret. Without fire control, her shots were about as inaccurate as you can get. The German fire, on the other hand, was extremely accurate. And the Exeter was taking a severe pounding. The distance between them was now down to only 6 miles, and although the Exeter was doing her best, her guns were being silenced. The devastation on the Exeter was impressive. After only 7 minutes, a direct hit took out the B turret on the Exeter, which is the second one at the front.
Okay.
That showered the bridge with shrapnel and killed absolutely everybody on the bridge, with the exception of the captain and his second in command. All the ship's communications were down. Captain Frederick Bell was wounded in both legs, his face and his eyes, and he was forced to go below to the rear command position. But he got no means of communicating to the rest of the ship, so he was forced to give commands via a change of wounded and unwounded sailors forming a line down to the steering station, because it couldn't steer it. You know, steering it from below, he's commanding it from three decks above. You've got a line of sailors, giving the captain gives the order. Number one then gives the repeats like it,
Chinese
and it's
just
Chinese whispers all the way down.
You wonder if someone went abandon ship halfway down the line.
But the captain managed to he managed to continue the fight.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got one turret left.
And he's still fighting on.
And he's still fighting. I mean, amid the devastation, some of the Exeter deck crews managed to find torpedo tubes still in their compressed air tubes, and they fired them at the Graf Spee. They all missed.
But they still fired.
Yeah. By 7 a.m, the Exeter's forward gun turret's completely gone. Only one rear turret was capable of returning fire, but it wasn't accurate because it had to be aimed by local control. In fact, it was aimed by a bloke standing on top of it. The fire had was rain. Well, there was a major fire in the chief petty officer's quarters and the Marines' mess. There were no telephone communications. Only one other gun could be fired, and that was a 4-inch gun.
That's a little gun.
That's a little gun. Both aircraft had been, well, they'd been blown to bits. The wireless communications had broken down, but the engine room was still virtually untouched, and the ship had power.
Right. At this point,
the Exeter lost sight of the Graf Spee. The Germans had put up a smoke screen.
Hmm.
So the Graf Spee disappeared into the smoke. It gave a brief respite and a chance to patch up some of the damaged areas, but she was not fit to stay in the fight. She's out of it. At this point, the battle was now down to the two.
If you want jazz music, go to New Orleans. Bagels, New York. And for psychics, think California Psychics. You want the best, you go to the best. At California Psychics, home of free spirits and open minds, we know better than anyone what makes a good psychic. That's why we guarantee, if your reading isn't life-changing, it's free. Visit CaliforniaPsychics.com and experience the joy of certainty. California Psychics.
Save big money on your next project right now at Menards. Give your home an elegant look with Mastercraft pre-finished hardwood molding. Available in 5 pre-finished colors to save you time. Just cut and install for a simple upgrade to any room. Save big on all Mastercraft molding products. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.
Two light cruisers with their 6-inch guns against the far superior guns, the 11-inch guns, of the Graf Spee.
Yeah.
Not realising how badly damaged the Exeter was, the Graf Spee continued to fire on her from within the smoke screen. The Exeter was just too badly damaged to continue the fight and possibly too damaged to even stay afloat. Still, with her engines producing power, she tried to get away. She tried to head south for the nearest British port, which was actually in the Falkland Islands. It wasn't until Harwood, who saw what was going on, ordered the two light cruisers to close in on the Graafspee, that the German ship temporarily stopped attacking the Exeter. And up to this point, the Ajax and the Achilles had actually been ineffectual. They had 4-inch guns and aren't making the slightest dent on this ship.
Yeah.
And they'd actually fired more than 5 salvos a minute at the German ship.
And it did nothing.
But the cruisers had only hit it 4 times in the first 18 minutes.
That's not good.
And they'd spent 1,000 shells.
And hit it 4 times.
I mean, that was a success rate of 0.004%.
That's pretty bad.
It's not bad, it's awful.
Yeah, that is pretty bad.
Then this changed once they drew a little bit closer. Now under her own smoke screen, and the Exeter, who was on fire and slowly sinking, started to withdraw south. And the light cruisers started to actually score hits on the German ship. Now, when HMS Achilles opened fire on the German battleship, the Graafspee, she became the first New Zealand unit to engage the enemy in the Second World War. So just a little fact I threw in there.
Yeah. Interesting.
HMNZS, isn't it?
Yeah.
Her Majesty's New Zealand ship.
Yeah. His Majesty's Achilles. Now. Would have been His Majesty's then,
yeah. See, at that point, up to that point, the two smaller ships had been virtually ignored, but after a brief pause to change the turret angles and that, the Graafspee started firing on the two cruisers, and they started to suffer the same fate as HMS Exeter.
Yeah.
As the Exeter slipped away from the fight in a cloud of her own smoke, and some of it self-generated, others were just from the fires on board, Harwood made the decision to break off from the fight and hope that he could re-attack with his two smaller ships after nightfall. He believed that the Graafspee had suffered very little damage. His own ship, HMS Ajax, had taken a pounding with 2 of its 4 turrets already put out of action, and he didn't believe that his 2 remaining ships were having any effect on their German battleship. In fact, he actually said, "We might as well be bombarding her with a load of bloody snowballs."
Yeah.
it's an official quote. At 20 to 8, he signalled Achilles to make smoke and move away. The whole engagement had lasted 2 hours.
Yeah, just get away from there now.
Just get out of there. In reality, though, the German ship had taken more hits than the British commander knew. The Graafspee had actually received 23 hits. That's still not very good when you consider she's been hit by the Exeter and the other two, and the other two had fired over 1,000 shots and only hit it 4 times.
Yeah.
So it's not good, but that 37 German sailors had been killed, 57 wounded. And Langsdorff himself had actually sustained a shoulder injury. Additionally, the Graafspee had fired over 400 rounds, in fact, 414 rounds of their 11-inch ammunition, which was 70% of what it held.
Oh, wow. So if they'd have carried on, they would have had no ammo left.
The damage inflicted by the three British ships was not dangerous to the immediate effect of the it wasn't going to cause the ship, the Graafspee, a problem. But a return to Germany across the wintry Atlantic wasn't going to be possible without repairs. And one of the things that was actually put out of action was the freshwater plant on the Graafspee.
Okay.
So it could have made it across the Atlantic, but it wouldn't have been very comfortable and wouldn't have been very nice.
No.
So as Harwood was making its decision to break off the attack, Langsdorff was making a decision to run for a neutral port. for some hurried maintenance and make the ship fully seaworthy. The German ship had suffered 37 casualties, but none of them had come from the captured British sailors, who were still held below decks as prisoners. And trapped below decks, they had no communication with anybody to keep track of the battle. They knew that they were involved in a battle because of the sound of the guns on the Spey, and from the shuddering caused by the British ships actually making contact and hitting them. In fact, some of the shrapnel from the British shells had actually penetrated the area where the prisoners were, and it gave them a small view to the outside world, but only a limited one. But they did know that if the Graf Spee was sunk, they would have no chance of survival. They were locked below decks.
Yeah.
So, with the two remaining British ships withdrawing to a perceived safe distance, Langsdorff had a major decision to make. The battle had taken place in the bay of the River Plate. For those not familiar with it, it's a large area of open sea, about 120 miles across. Langsdorff needed to make his ship capable of an Atlantic crossing in order to get back to Germany, which realistically meant he needed a reasonable-sized port. All of the possible options, unfortunately, were British-controlled or in neutral countries. The port of Buenos Aires was his preferred destination because Argentina was sympathetic to the German cause. But there was a problem. The river leading to the Argentine capital was shallow and would limit his ship's manoeuvrability. And it was also silty, so it could block up his water intakes, bearing in mind he had diesel engines, not steam turbines.
Yeah.
Yeah. So instead, he chose the Uruguayan port of Montevideo.
I don't know where that is, but I'm going
to... It's in Uruguay. It's the opposite side of the...
It's the other side of the
entrance to the River Plate.
Yeah.
Now, as HMS Ajax and Achilles emerged from the smoke screen they'd used to hide from the Graf Spee, they were amazed to see the German ship heading west. It could have gone anywhere. And as far as the British ships and Harwood were concerned, the German ship had only suffered mild damage. And it became clear by late afternoon that the Graf Spee was heading for the Bay of La Plata. Now, as the three remaining ships maintained their position, they headed towards Uruguay. Ajax on the left-hand side of the Graf Spee and Achilles on the right, but they were keeping a safe distance, you know, out of range. And they were all trying to repair their damage. As the Graf Spee entered the entrance, she fired several shots at the Ajax and then the Achilles, both of which replied, but they didn't actually hit the other ship.
Yeah,
so the ship's
like
fired
a warning shot.
A couple of warning shots. Now, those few shells marked the end of the actual hostilities, which had now lasted 10 hours. The Graf Spee eased slowly into the Bay of La Plata, completely dark. All her lights were off. Only a silhouette to the thousands of people already gathered on the banks of the port of Montevideo. They'd heard the naval battle at sea. And now a bloody great German battleship is pulling into their harbour.
Yeah.
Just after midnight, the Graf Spee dropped anchor and swung gently to the water's movement, silent, deadly, and a very menacing shadow in the middle of the harbour.
Yeah.
Trouble is, once the Graf Spee had entered the harbour at Montevideo, she was immediately subject to the rules of neutrality. Basically, a ship from a warring nation entering a neutral port had 24 hours before being required to leave. Now, there was an exception in the rule from the Hague Convention of 1907 that allowed more time if a ship required repairs to make it seaworthy, but its crew could not add to its fighting efficiency. So they can't repair the guns. They can't repair the armour, but they can make it so that it's seaworthy. It can go. But the interpretation of this is left to the authorities in that neutral country. Mm-hmm. They added another provision, and that provision was that a merchant ship from a warring nation located in a neutral port could not be pursued by an opposing nation's warship in that same port for 24 hours.
Okay. So you can't just wait outside the port for them to leave and then go, nah, we're going to sink you now.
No. So you have the German battleship in the harbour. It's there, but it can only be there for 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
If a British ship or an enemy of Germany is already in that harbour and leaves, the German ship cannot leave for a further 24 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's basically the gist of it. So before she'd even dropped anchor, the officials of Uruguay, Germany, France and Britain had already begun to establish diplomatic and military positions. The Germans wanted time to make repairs, which they estimated would be 2 weeks. The British and French pressed for the 24-hour rule, and the poor old Uruguayan government is stuck in the middle.
Hmm.
Now, Langsdorff didn't know it at the time, but the only thing preventing him from leaving Montevideo that night through any of the unguarded channels and just disappearing into the South Atlantic were two very small, badly damaged British light cruisers versus a battleship.
Yeah.
No contest.
No, not really.
You know, I mean, he might even get out without seeing them.
Yeah.
They might not even spot him leaving. He's in there, but he's got all his lights off.
Yeah. And it's midnight.
It's midnight in the middle of the year. But there we go. But eventually, Langsdorff was given 3 days, but told he must leave within 72 hours. So the Uruguayan government gave him a little bit of leeway. The British Admiralty weren't sitting back either. They started rumours that several capital warships would be joining Harwood's flotilla in the coming hours. They used coded messages in Argentinian and Uruguayan newspaper to identify the British ships waiting outside the harbour, knowing that the Germans would decode the messages.
Hmm.
And I believe what they did is they used the racing results for Britain, and they put, like, coming in first, one head above was HMS, was Ark Royal.
Yeah.
And second place was Hood.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the Germans picked up on this, and that's how they did it.
It's quite a clever way of doing it.
But it was all false.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, a call was even placed to the British consulate on an unsecured phone line giving the same information, along with a request for them to arrange fuel for two British battlecruisers expected to arrive the following day. So basically, the British phoned the Argentinian consulate and said, look, we've got two British battleships turning up in the next few hours. Can you have some fuel ready for them? And the grief they got from the other end, this isn't a secure line, you can't. It was amazing. In fact, if you actually watch the film, there's a film called The Battle of the River Plate. It's quite good. That interaction between that phone call and the Argentinian, it's actually quite an interesting...
Yeah, I'll have to listen to that.
It's quite a good one. But it was all totally false. There was only one ship that could make it.
Mm.
And that was the heavy cruiser HMS Cumberland. And the Graf Spee had already destroyed one of those heavy cruisers, the Exeter. So yeah, it's not really much of a match.
No.
No other French or British ship could reach the River Plate in the time frame. But the citizens of Montevideo were enthralled. They got spectacle of the German ship's presence. I mean, reporters from all over the world arrived, gathered news and watched all the activity in the port. In fact, the eyes and ears of the whole world were now in the harbour of the Uruguayan capital. To fill the hours of airtime required to keep people listening to the radio broadcasts, the broadcasters repeated every single rumour that floated across the city, which mostly dealt with the British reinforcements.
Yeah.
The British bluff was actually effective. Langsdorff began to believe that a run for the sea with all the gathering British forces outside the bay was suicidal. As the sun came up on the 14th of December, German sailors were seen feverishly working on the deck of the battleship while its captain was ashore trying to get an extension to the 72 hours. It was during that day that the British changed strategy. Knowing that the Germans were prevented from making repairs to the fighting strength of the ship, the decision was made to try and keep her in the harbour for as long as possible to enable the French and German, French and British battleships and aircraft carriers actually to get there.
Yeah.
So a plan was drawn up that the British merchant ships in Montevideo Harbour were to begin leaving to delay the Graf Spee another 24 hours each time.
Oh, yeah, that's sensible.
The British would then send another merchant ship to ensure another 24 hours and so on. The Uruguayans wouldn't have it. They insisted that the 72-hour rule stood fast. That period would expire at 8 p.m. local time, 17th of December 1939. After that, the German ship would be interned until the end of the war.
Yeah. Oh, can they do that? Can they hold on to it then?
They can't leave. That's it. Now, they will prevent it from leaving. On the 15th of December, the funeral was held with the 37 German officers and sailors killed in the battle. During this service, all the Germans gave the Nazi salute, except Langsdorff, who saluted with the old German naval hand salute. He's not a Nazi.
Yeah.
On that same day, the British sailors that had been imprisoned on board during the battle were released. Not one had been injured.
Well, they shouldn't have been. Prisoners of war.
Last-minute negotiations continued through the day, with Langsdorff being in contact with the German ambassador and the commanders of the Kriegsmarine in Germany. But still, the Uruguayan authorities refused to extend the 72-hour ruling. The next day, Langsdorff made his decision. The German command had given him three choices. Press the Uruguayans for more time. Break out to sea and make a run for it. Or fight his way to Buenos Aires, since the Argentinians were more pro-German than his present hosts. They're your three options, mate. That's what you're going to take. He knew that the Uruguayan authorities were not going to extend the 72-hour deadline. A fight in the narrow channels to Buenos Aires would put his ship at a distinct advantage, so his only option was to make a break for open water past what he believed was now a vastly superior force now waiting outside on the coastal waters of Uruguay. Now, nothing can remain a secret, or nothing could remain a secret, in the Uruguayan capital for long. And Langsdorff's plan was ruined when the merchant ship, a British one, up anchored and left at 6 in the evening. He now had to wait 24 hours before he could do the same. This only gave the Graf Spee 1 hour 45 minutes, gave him a window of 1 hour and 3 quarters the next day to actually leave.
Ah, so he couldn't...
Can't go before, because it's a 24-hour rule.
So what about if the British then released another ship?
It would have caused major problems, but yeah. I don't think the British would be able to. The Uruguayan authorities were going to prevent...
Yeah.
They'd have prevented them from leaving. They'd have said, no, you wait till the German ship goes first.
Yeah.
So I think that's why that didn't happen. They've now got 1 hour and 45 minutes. The British now know when the German ship's going to leave.
Yeah, that's quite clever, actually.
He still had a plan. Langsdorff still had a plan for what he was going to do. And he sought approval from Berlin. And he actually obtained Adolf Hitler's personal consent for the plan. He called a meeting of the Grash Bay's senior officers on the evening of the 16th. Now, they had one day, just on one day, to put this plan into action. So preparations began early in the morning on the 17th, and they went on throughout the day. Boats were called over from Buenos Aires in nearby Argentina, which has a large German population, and they took off some of the officers and some of the ratings. Shortly before 6 o'clock in the evening, on the 17th of December, smoke belched out of the funnel of the Grash Bay. And minutes later, with the battle ensigns flying on both the front and rear masts, the Grash Bay weighed anchor and proceeded out of the harbour to engage the British. The eyes and ears of the world listened as she powered her way out of the harbour towards the waiting British and the open sea. An hour after sailing, 4 miles off the coast, the Grash Bay stops. The two battle flags were hauled down and the ship was evacuated. In actual fact, only 41 sailors had left with Captain Hans Langsdorff. At 7:54, 6 minutes to eight in the evening on the 17th of December, the now abandoned ship exploded. Columns of flame and smoke rose from the ship. 5 minutes later, there was another massive explosion when the flames reached the magazine. The crew had actually spent their last day on board destroying all of the ship's key technical and technical equipment. And then they set charges that would ultimately sink the ship. Berlin had been advised of the captain's plan and responded with the order that under no circumstances was the ship to be interned or captured.
Yeah.
The Grash Bay's officers and ship's company were formally interned in Argentina. Bearing in mind, although they are pro-German, they're still an independent country and they're still not in the war. And they were interned on the 19th of December, despite efforts to have them recognised as shipwrecked sailors, which technically they were, because the ship had gone down outside Uruguayan waters and therefore not liable to internment. But the Argentinians, on your bike, sunshine. You're taking the pee. Yeah?
Yeah.
However, to be honest, over the coming months, a lot of the German sailors managed to get back to Germany with help from sympathisers in Argentina. Now, the place chosen for Langsdorff for actually scuttling his ship, which is the word used for what he's done,
yeah,
it wasn't deep enough for it to sink. She went to the bottom, but the majority of the ship stayed upright and above the waterline. The charges that the German crew had set were so successful that the whole ship burned for 3 days. And today, she settled in the mud and lies in 7 to 8 metres of water, depending on the tide, and she's still there today.
It's still there.
Still there.
It's not underwater anymore.
So it never went underwater.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
And although damaged, HMS Ajax and the New Zealand ship Achilles were repaired and continued to serve throughout the whole of the war. Achilles was actually decommissioned in 1946 and then Ajax in 1949. HMS Exeter made it to the British base at the Falkland Islands. She was severely damaged by the Grash Bay, but she was repaired and put back into service. And she was actually sunk at the Second Battle of the Java Sea, the 1st of March 1942. Most of her crew survived the sinking, but a quarter of them died in Japanese captivity.
Wow.
Commodore Henry Harwood was promoted to Rear Admiral and knighted for his role.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Died in 1950, aged 62. Captain Hans Langsdorff was taken off his ship before the explosive charges detonated, and he joined his crew in internment in Argentina. He was taken to the Naval Hospital in Buenos Aires, where, on the evening of the 19th of December, he addressed the crew and of the Graf Spee before writing two letters, one to his wife and one to the German ambassador in Buenos Aires, asking him to relay to his superiors in the German Navy. So he's written a letter to his wife, he's written a letter to the German commanders of the German Navy. And in this letter, he gave the reasons for his action. He then dressed in his dress uniform, along with his captain's sword, and went up to his room. He was in the Naval Hotel, Buenos Aires. He lay down on the Graf Spee's battle flag and committed suicide with his firearm.
Why?
Now, some have labelled Captain Zuzi Hans Langsdorff as a coward for not fighting. Personally, I think he was conned into believing that neither he or his ship would survive to get back to Germany. I think he was one of the very few commanders that tried to look after his crew and those he was responsible for, prisoners. I mean, while acting as a surface raider, not a single merchant crew member died.
Yeah.
He rescued or arranged for them to be rescued on each occasion.
Yep.
He wasn't a Nazi, and I think he did his best given the circumstances. That's the story of the first naval battle to take place in the Second World War. The Admiral Graf Spee lost 37 officers and men. HMS Exeter lost 66. HMS Achilles lost 4. And HMNZS Achilles lost 4. And HMS Ajax lost 7. That is the Battle of the Graf of the River Plate.
See, I think that's quite interesting. I don't understand this, why he killed himself though at the end. That doesn't, because he had approval from Hitler to do what he was supposed to do.
I think he kind of had approval.
Hmm.
But I think circumstances by the time he would have got back to Germany would have proved that there wasn't a massive British fleet outside.
That's not his fault.
He's a captain.
Yeah.
He has to take the responsibility. You think of Erwin Rommel.
Yeah.
Erwin Rommel didn't do anything wrong, but he lost North Africa.
Yeah.
And was executed by Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, that's true.
So you kind of think, I think Langsdorff knew, realistically, that he'd screwed up.
Couldn't he have just stayed in Argentina, though?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
But strange. Yeah, so I was kind of, I looked at the river. There is a film called The Battle of the River Plate. It was made in about late 50s.
I think that's where I've heard the story, like I've heard the name before. Because I said I've heard the name of that, never actually knew a thing about it. I mean, it's interesting because it's a battle, but no ships were destroyed.
Like, I think Exeter came extremely close.
Yeah.
I think, to be honest, if Langsdorff had have made a run for the sea, we would have lost Ajax and Achilles.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. You know, and if HMS Cumberland had actually have made it there,
they probably would have lost that as well.
They'd have lost that as well.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the Exeter was so badly damaged. And there are pictures, I might post one actually, of HMS Exeter in the Falklands with all the damage on it.
Mm.
I mean, it had lost all but one turret. You know, yeah, it's got bad. Two at the front, and they're both out of action very quickly. You know, the crew at the bridge, which is behind turret B, they're wiped out, with the exception of the captain, who's badly injured, and the first officer.
Yeah,
and he's got to go down to the back of the ship to command it from there, where he can't see what's going on.
Mm.
The only turret that's actually working is being directed by some bloke standing close to it, you know, going, oh, yeah, point it over there. You know, or as far as I can see, it's missed.
Yeah.
You know, and the grass spray's not sitting there doing nothing. It's firing at you and it's got smoke. It's creating smoke so you can't see it. I think, you know, I just think the grass spray was unlucky.
Yeah. Yeah. Really.
It would have made, I think, to be honest, given the damage that it sustained, it would have made it to Germany.
Yeah. The British did a good job in, basically.
They did a very good job, yeah. False news.
Yeah. Yeah, we're very good at that.
We were good at that.
Yeah. Anyway, I think that's interesting. I'd say it's another naval one to add to your list.
Oh, yeah, there's a few, isn't
there? Yeah, there's a few naval ones, so.
You wonder where my interests lie.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I like that. I like, for this, something like that, where I don't know a thing about it, I don't chime in as much. You notice that when I don't know anything about it, I just sort of sit there and listen. So no, I hope everyone else enjoyed that, because like I said, with us being an island, a lot of our history is naval. You know, it is something that's quite important to this country. You know, even now we still have a great navy. I mean, it's not as good as it used to. It's not as big as it used to be.
It certainly isn't as big as it used to be.
But I think even now you'd struggle against the British Navy, most navies in the world. I mean, the Americans wouldn't, because it's...
But they've just got the numbers.
They've got an unbelievable amount of naval ships.
I mean, the American aircraft carrier probably fit all of our ships inside it.
Yeah.
But yeah. No, I mean, we wouldn't be able to compete against the American Navy.
I don't think we'd be able to
a direct thing. There's not enough.
Well, the fact that we share an aircraft carrier with the French tells you everything, really, about our navy right now. It's not the power it used to be. But no, I mean, it's very, very interesting. And like I said, it's World War II, which is like my favorite, one of my favorite subjects in history, because it's, to me, it's a type of history that it means something to me, because Grandpa was in the Second World War, and it's, you know, grew up. I know he never really spoke about the war, did he? He never really spoke about it, but...
No, he didn't. We know where he was and what he got involved in, and yes.
But yeah, very, very interesting. So, yeah, thank you for that, and I do hope everyone else enjoyed that. And if, like we said it in last week's episode, if you do want to get in contact with us, please feel free. If you want to leave any feedback on the podcast, you don't actually have to do it through, a lot of people don't do it through like Apple Music. You can leave reviews on Apple Music. We're finding a lot of people aren't doing that, but people do comment on the pictures. So if you do listen to the podcast and you do want to leave a comment, but you can't do it on whatever media you're using to listen, because I know
leave it on the Facebook page.
Yeah, I'm on Spotify and I can't leave reviews on Spotify. I don't use Apple Music. So if you can't do that, then, you know, join us on Facebook, leave us a message and let us know what you thought. So, yeah, thank you very much.
And if there's any subjects you want us to cover.
Yeah.
It does take me a number of weeks to do enough research to put these together.
Yeah.
They're not sort of... all the facts that I have on here are checked more than once from different sources. So if they are wrong,
it's your fault.
it's unlikely.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are things. And I will cover any subject. You know, I've got a couple in the pipeline for you that.
Yeah, there's some really interesting ones. And like I said,
one day I might actually do a short one.
Yeah, I don't believe that. I'm trying to expand the knowledge a little bit, you know, because obviously we've moved the way we were sort of focusing on British history, and we've sort of gone a bit to the Americans, done quite a few American history. I've done an Australian one, a Japanese one, you've done a Chinese one. So we are sort of broadening the horizon a little bit. I believe
most of the stuff
I did that... Ivan the Terrible as well. So
most of the ones that I know about are stuff that is like you get in British history books. But every single country has a history. And I don't know what they teach in places like France or Italy or Russia or New Zealand, you know, there may well be some equally fantastic stories that we can do podcasts on from these other countries that we know absolutely nothing about. Give us a suggestion. I will quite happily do the research and relay that information to the wider podcasts.
Yes, but not French.
I don't mind doing the French.
Yeah, you can do French. I won't be doing the French.
It depends.
If it's Agincourt or something like that.
Well, you mean where we... yeah. I mean, yeah. French, you've got Joan of Arc.
Yes.
We've not covered. She's an interesting character. Mm. We have the French Revolution. Yeah. They're two off the top of my head. I know you don't like the French.
Let them eat cake.
You know, but every country... has a history. Every country has a fantastic story that I probably, you know, I've never heard of. And I'm quite happy to research and put it out in the form that we put it out in.
The French Revolution sounds quite interesting, actually, where they killed their king.
Yeah, we did that.
Yeah, we did do that. James the Second, wasn't it?
Charles the First.
Charles the First. That's the one. James the Second was... his dad, wasn't he? Sir Stuart. James the First was the first Stuart king. Then it was James the Second. Then Charles.
And then there's a gap with Mr. Cromwell.
Yeah,
and then
he's a pillock. And then
then Charles the Second.
Then Charles the Second. Yeah, I'm sure that's right. I'm going to check this now because I can't.
And then the Great Fire of London.
I'm going to have to
1666.
I'm going to have to check this now. I've got a picture on my phone of the kings. Where are we? Edward the Fourth, Richard the Third, Henry the Eighth. James the First. No, James the First's son was Charles the First. So it's Charles. So it was James the First's son. I just thought that was James the Second, but it wasn't. So it was James, Charles, then a big gap, then Charles the Second, then James the Second.
No, right.
And James the Second was the first foreign one we had, and then we had Mary, William, Anne, George, however many bloody Georges we had in a row, and then Will, Victoria.
That's just easy to spell, isn't it? I mean, you've got King George the what, yeah.
Well, they were all Dutch, weren't they? So they weren't even English or German, so...
It's amazing that like, we've had two world wars against the Germans, and they're our monarchy.
What was their real name? The king's real surname? It's not Windsor, was it? I want to say it's like...
Habsburg.
Yeah, Habsburg, or go to Habsburg or something like
something that. Something like that, yeah. You know, that's like, you've got me stumped now and I'm supposed to know about history.
King's real surname. Let's have a look. I know I shouldn't really be doing this.
You're Googling it whilst on a podcast. That's absolutely fantastic, isn't it? Like,
it says Mountbatten, Windsor, but it's not.
It's not.
No.
They changed it to First World War, so they didn't actually...
King George, wasn't it? George the Fifth.
First World War, they changed their name because they didn't want to be associated with the Germans.
That was George the Seventh, wasn't it? No, George the Fifth. What more than George the Seventh? We haven't had seven.
We haven't had George the Seventh.
George the Fifth.
You know, this podcast is going to go out and they're going to go, what the hell? They don't even know what they're talking about.
No, I can't remember. Yeah, it changed his surname. Coburg and Gotha.
Saxon Coburg, yeah.
Yeah, I knew it was German. I was close. I thought it was go to Saxburg, not Saxburg.
I wasn't even close.
Yeah, but yeah, it's weird.
That's embarrassing.
It's weird to think that, though, isn't it? Like,
this is going out, you know that, and I'm like, I'm just thinking...
Yeah.
How can you talk about history when you don't even know your kings?
I know the kings. There was an old song on... do you ever watch Horrible Histories?
You mean the children's programme?
Yes. Have you ever watched it?
Occasionally, I've seen it when it's...
So, they do a song... I don't know all of it, but it starts with William.
I know a song, but I don't know it. Yeah.
No, it starts with William the First, and it goes William, Henry, Stephen, Henry, Richard, John, and they're the first kings of England.
All right.
But yeah, we did have a King Stephen as well.
We did have a King Stephen, yes.
Who stole the throne from his cousin, who was actually... But we couldn't have a queen at that point because we were sexist.
That's another one we could do.
What, King Stephen, who stole the throne?
Pre William the First, the Queen of the Iceni.
Yes, yes.
Depending on whether you grew up 60s, 70s, 80s, or the 2000s.
Yeah.
Depending on how you pronounce
it. It was Boadicea.
Boadicea is how I would pronounce it.
Yeah, that's how I pronounce it.
Boudica
is how it's pronounced.
Is how it's pronounced now.
Yeah. I grew up with it.
I actually kind of think that's not a bad one, you know.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
I have to think about that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good
Because she stuffed the Romans, didn't she? The Italians.
Until they got
their own back.
Yeah. So, right, well, thanks for listening to the rabble at the end.
We always have a little rabble at the end.
Yeah.
Well, oh, dear.
Thank you very much, guys. And, we'll see you next week.
If you want jazz music, go to New Orleans. Bagels, New York. And for psychics, think California Psychics. You want the best, you go to the best. At California Psychics, home of free spirits and open minds, we know better than anyone what makes a good psychic. That's why we guarantee, if your reading isn't life-changing, it's free. Visit CaliforniaPsychics.com and experience the joy of certainty. California Psychics.
Save big on all your Halloween needs, all in the Kroger app. Get tender bone-in pork back ribs for $3.49 a pound with your card. Then get 16-ounce packages of juicy strawberries for $1.99 with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.